Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear from Sahar Kajanori in conversation with singer-songwriter and filmmaker Pete Sands. Pete's been on the show in the past, and we'll catch up during the second half of the program. In the meantime,
carry on my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
Kansas will be at Morongo Casino and Resort Friday, June 1st. The band has been touring constantly every year for their 40-some-year existence, and with the exception of a strange period which lasted for only a few years, the band has always had a strong violin presence. David Ragsdale is the violinist currently touring with the band. He's been with Kansas for around 28 years, but he's young enough to have already been a fan when he convinced Kansas to start using a violin again. We'll get that story in just a bit. It's a pretty cool one. He's also played, though, with some other bands that I'm sure you'll know of, and got a start rather early, earlier than most would be able to even ask for music lessons. I asked him if it was a choice or something thrust upon him.
Yeah, I was certainly younger than I wanted it thrusted upon me. My mom wanted a violinist. She wanted a pet violinist, and
You were the one.
Yeah, that's how I started, as young as I did. I had no interest. I wanted to stay home and watch Mighty Mouse.
Of course.
But no.
No. Okay, well, did you end up enjoying it later? I mean, you ended up staying with it, but was this, again, a parental thing? Or because you were staying with it?
It ended up being the better choice. I wanted to be a guitar player. I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. That was when I was maybe five.
Mm.
Boy, that's what I wanted to do, you know. But that ended up being a huge battle between me and my mother that I eventually won when I was about 14.
Ah.
The violin, I never got any better than I was forced to get. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't want to play it. I hated it, really, honestly.
Oh, gosh.
So I ran off and started playing the guitar and actually became pretty proficient at it. And then all of a sudden, it became real apparent that there were thousands of really good guitar players. I mean, really good, you know. I had no idea there were so many that good. Then I started thinking about career opportunities. Like, you know, maybe that violin wasn't such a bad idea.
Yeah.
So I went back to it and probably went back to it too late. I'll never be as good as I was on guitar, on violin, but, you know, I get the job done, I guess.
Seem to have stayed with it at least through school, and you
oh,
seem
I've
to
stayed with it. Yeah, I have. I went back to the violin and stayed there
after school with Louise Mandrell. Then was that as a fiddler, or were you playing the guitar for her?
I played guitar and violin, mostly violin.
Okay.
The guitar became this back pocket instrument. I guess I was about 18 or 19 when I said, "Okay, I better go back to the violin, or I'm not going to have any gigs."
Right. Now, after Louise Mandrell, I suppose, you were with her for, I guess, some 4 years. Was there any lag time between Mandrell and Kansas, or was that a direct jump there?
It was about 6 months. I started petitioning Kansas right after they released Power. Like, maybe my second year with Louise. They released Power without a violinist, with Steve Morse. So you have Steve Morse, who, you know, had the Dixie Dregs with a violin. And you have Kansas with a violin, and there's no violinist in this new band, in this incarnation of Kansas. There's no violinist. And I could hear the violin parts in my head that weren't there. And a real good friend of mine said, well, what you ought to do is sit down with your little four-track, you know, put Kansas down on two tracks and put yourself on two tracks and mix it all together and show them what it would have sounded like if you'd been on the record.
And this is what
you
did?
That's a great idea. So that's what I did. I took four or five of the songs off of Power and added violin parts to them and managed to get a copy of that to Phil Ehart, the drummer and manager for Kansas. The hard part was getting the tape to the band. I must have sent out about 60 of them, and finally one of them landed. And they were in the middle of their tour. I mean, I think Phil called me from Detroit or something like that. And I was hoping he was just going to hire me on the spot. But that didn't happen. I had to chase him around for another 4 years.
That's incredible that you actually did it.
It really is. I mean, that's a one in a million. You know, kids chasing their favorite band around and get hired. That doesn't happen much.
No, you read about that every so often.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like Adrian
Ballou.
And most
of the time it's a lie. You know, it's in a movie or something like that. And then, you know.
Another Bob Dylan fairy tale or something.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been trying to get a bead on what you might have been catching your ear musically as you were growing up. You're just about 6 years older than I. So as far as mainstream radio, there wouldn't have been much featuring the violin. You had to have been only 12 or so with Jean-Luc Ponty and Frank Zappa and all that. And even with the Mahavishnu Orchestra and Electric Light Orchestra. There, I finally named something mainstream, the Electric Light Orchestra, but I really don't think it was until Kansas. I guess you probably, were about 18 by the time Left Overture came out, and really noticing violin for the first time, mainstream. Did that give you hope?
Mainstream, yeah. I was maybe 16 the first time I heard, I want to say it was Can I Tell You. I think it was the song Can I Tell You, came on the radio. And I was familiar already with those guys you had just named. I was listening to Jean-Luc Ponty, and I was a big Jerry Goodman fan.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I was listening to because there were no rock violinists to listen to. And here came Can I Tell You on the radio, and all of a sudden here's this kind of ripping rock violin thing going on. Actually, that was one of the moments at which I started going, you know, a violin might not be such a bad idea. That was an epiphanic moment. is that a word?
No, it is now.
It is now.
This is NPR.
Epiphanic. We just created a word. And also, I heard a friend of mine, we had studied violin at the same time, younger, and he kept with it and got really good. And he played the Mendelssohn Concerto. I was growing up in Columbus, Georgia. Mm. And he played the Mendelssohn Concerto with the Columbus Symphony Orchestra. And that just floored me. That was the first time I realized that violin was a really cool instrument. Seeing my friend play this really nice concerto really well with the Columbus Symphony Orchestra, that all happened around the same time, and that's when I said, okay, I'm going back to the violin.
The only other mainstream thing any of us could think of would be Devil Went Down to Georgia, but you would have been 20 by the time that came around.
No, that came out, I want to say 75, maybe 74.
But yeah, another time where it's actually featured, and it just we did not get that on mainstream radio. I mean, even AM, which gave us, I think, a better variety.
Oh, we got it down in Georgia.
Okay, well, yeah, I guess you would. You sure
it was all over the place in Georgia.
That's right. I kind of forget who am I speaking to. This may be the time to point out for listeners, this may be the time to point out that anyone listening to Queensryche, Sign of the Times, and getting zapped right out of the headbanging haze to the sound of a violin carrying out the last 25 seconds or so. Okay, so this is David Ragsdale as well. How did you end up with Queensryche? This seems like a far cry from some of the other material you'd been working on.
I established some pretty good friendships up in Nashville that I maintained.
Oh, okay.
And this was right after I left Kansas the first time.
Mm.
And one of my friends from Nashville ended up as a liaison. And he called me up and said, hey, Queensryche's in town. They needed a violin. I wonder if you wanted to come up here and do it. And I was so excited. And I went out and I wasn't all that familiar with Queensryche. I mean, I was familiar with them, but not intimately.
Right.
I went out and bought a couple of albums, you know, and did some homework. And it's like, all right, I'm going up to work with Queensryche, man. And got up there and I walked into the recording booth with an unlit cigarette and a Diet Coke and came out like 45 seconds later, done. I was heartbroken because, I was gonna groove with Queensryche, and all they needed was just a little tail, just a fade out, and that was it. I was done.
Oh, wow. I was trying to figure out if that was the whole part or if you were layered underneath the solos earlier. That was it. That was that whole thing, huh?
That was it. That was it. I was done.
Wow. And then I guess was it also the Nashville connection that got you in with Jason Bonham and then the Smashing Pumpkins with Luna and more notably Disarm?
That was an Atlanta connection. Kansas did Live at the Whiskey in 93 or something like that. And we mixed the record here in Atlanta at Triclops Studio. Smashing Pumpkins recorded Siamese Dream at Triclops. And Billy Corbin said, you know, we need to get some Atlanta Symphony guys. I've got an idea for some string tracks. We need to get some string players over here. And the guy said, wait a minute. Give me an idea of what these string tracks sound like. And Billy told him, and he said, no, you don't want the ASO guys. I know the guy you need to call. So that's how the Smashing Pumpkins thing happened.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, that was nice. And also the same thing happened with Jason. They recorded their record at Triclops.
Speaking with David Ragsdale, violinist with Kansas, though with many other projects under his belt. Kansas will be at Morongo Casino and Resort Friday, June 1st. More information at morongocasinoresort.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Now, David and Goliath, this is something that I didn't know about until I started digging up stuff for this interview. First of all, are you in control of this album?
I can send you one. I got plenty.
Okay. I'd like to hear of the conception of David and Goliath with, by the way, you on violin and guitar and how it came together. Uh-huh. And so, again, for folks listening, really a cool symphonic rock thing. PBS viewers may think of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, I suppose. I think of Joe Satriani, in all honesty, even though he's guitar. But
Joe Satriani was a big influence on me when that was going on. About half of that was written while I was still with Louise, and a lot of it had to do with Surfing with the Alien. I got a copy of Surfing with the Alien, and that hit me hard. I really enjoyed that record. Mm. And I started writing stuff. About six of those songs came out as just little ideas. I was messing around. I still had my little four-track that I'd cut the Kansas stuff on.
Wow.
I moved to L.A. from Nashville after I left Louise for about a year, and that was the period in between Louise and Kansas, and most of the rest of it was written while I was in L.A.
So when you did put this together, did you go around finding L.A. studio players? Were you just gathering musicians, or did you get people that you already knew and played with and were already synced in with pretty much?
Well, there was a drummer that auditioned with Louise from Nashville, a guy named Tom Norton, who just floored me in his audition with the band. We went through maybe five drummers, and for whatever reason, Tom wasn't the selected drummer with Louise's band. But I remember him leaving the room, and the bass player turned around to the rest of the band and said, is it just me, or does anyone else feel like he was the only guy in the room that knew the chart?
Oh, wow.
He was just phenomenal. I thought to myself at that moment, if I ever do anything, that's the guy I'm going to call. I had to find some way to get it recorded. And an old friend of mine inherited the gig at what used to be Capricorn Studios down in Macon.
Mm.
And he made it come together. I signed a little production deal with White Clay Records, I think they called it. And the bass player I wanted was Jerry Peake, who played bass on Steve Moore's band. And it was Jerry and Dave LaRue and Steve. Boy, Jerry was just awesome. And he was in Atlanta, and he did it.
Nice.
So I ended up with two just top-of-the-heap musicians.
Absolutely.
I ended up sequencing all the... I played keyboards, but I can't play keyboards, but I can program.
Right.
So I ended up, you know, typing all that stuff in note by note. It's tedious, but at least it came out what I wanted, you know.
Now, so you've left Kansas. And by the way, that reminds me, you brought up a point that as you look through the history of the band, it's either you or Robbie Steinhardt all the way through. And then I noticed that one little period that did not have a violin, and that just seemed odd. So you already answered the question. I was wondering if a person listened to Kansas at that point and were just hearing violin parts that weren't there.
I heard them the first. I couldn't believe it. I bought the record and was like, well, who's playing violin? I mean, this is Steve Morris in Kansas. They both, you know, two violin bands married with no violin. You could hear where they were supposed to be, or at least I could, and I'm sure other people did. I'm sure other people missed that texture because it was so prominent in both Kansas and Steve Morris. The violin was so prominent.
Yeah.
And there it wasn't.
So apart from Kansas, is there any time for any, let's just say, David and Goliath type of touring or even recording? I think some of this may be coming back with a bit of a prominence.
Probably not. I mean, something profound would have to happen. I did very poorly off that record.
Gotcha.
I mean, I ended up deep in debt. I mean, granted, I did spend more money on it than I probably should have.
Okay.
But I signed a bad deal with a bad label. They got most of the money that was made went to them. And there was a moment, you know, where the thing with a decent label, that there was a moment when Boxstabber was number one on a classic rock station in, I want to say, Philadelphia. I was doing some self-promoting. That was when I was new to the internet and everything, and I was contacting radio stations and people, and I was sending out tons of copies of CDs. But that floored me. I mean, it was number one in Philadelphia on a radio station. I called the label and I said, hey, Boxstabber's number one in Philadelphia. We got to get some product up there. And they said, well, we're out, man.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, what do you mean you're out? Well, we sold out of them. And I was like, well, make some more. And he was like, well, you know, we don't have the money. I was like, what did you do with the money you made off the 2,000 records that you sold? What are you talking about? You don't have any money.
Mm.
If you sold them all, you don't have any money? What are you talking about? And that's when I called the lawyer right after that.
Yeah.
I said, I need to get out of this deal. They haven't even sent me any money.
Oh,
and they're out of records. I signed a bad deal with a bad label, and that's all there was to it.
That's very unfortunate.
You know, people do that right and left. I'm not the first person that's happened to by a long shot.
You do exist on Kansas Recordings. There are a few great albums, The Live at the Whiskey.
That was a fun record to cut.
And I noticed
that was an exciting moment for me. I mean, you know, here I am on a Kansas record. That was kind of a culmination of a dream right there.
And I noticed you have writing credits on some of it.
On Freaks of Nature, I collaborated with Steve on four songs, I want to say.
Okay.
One of them was fairly extensive. It was a song called I Can Fly that Steve and I spent a lot of time together on. That was probably my most extensive contribution on that record.
Did you bring that in as an instrumental and somebody added the lyrics, or did you bring in the whole package? Did you have a cool riff? How did that one come together?
It was a cool riff with a development section that Steve really liked, and Steve bundled it up and took it home and spent the weekend with it and came back, and he said, all right, here's what I've done, and it was cool. And then we hammered out some other episodes, other moments, and hammered it all together, and it was fun. I really enjoyed that.
All right. The last thing, I suppose, even though you are with Kansas, which it's a vocal band for the most part, but some of the folks that I talk to are strictly instrumental players. When you're writing, do you often write purely to go into an instrumental type of song when it's all said and done? Or often when you write, do you picture lyrics floating in on top at times?
I'm not much of a lyricist. My vocabulary is a little too folksy. If I were to be a lyricist, it would come out country, almost all of it, because I just think in that vernacular, you know. You know what's moving me more than anything instrumentally is what's coming out of the bluegrass world. There's some incredible stuff. The skill level is just stunning. I mean, I used to kind of sneer at fiddle players, and then here comes Mark O'Connor.
There you go.
And he kind of revolutionized the entire genre, especially bluegrass, because all of a sudden everyone was like, man, I want to play like that. And it included not only fiddle players, but steel players and dobro players and guitar players. And,
oh, yeah. Even the banjo player, like Bela Fleck and all that funky
stuff. Yeah, here comes Bela Fleck and cool stuff. Boy, there's a big, fat, double handful of fiddle players that are just remarkable.
Yeah.
I was watching a video of Stuart Duncan.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Boy, do I envy his bow arm. Goodness gracious, that guy can play.
It's absurd. Well, they've ushered into a nice new generation. Well, and now, speaking of which, there's a segue if I ever wrote one. This, Kansas. Kansas has gone for, I guess, 40 years. Now, do you ever run into young people who, quote, know you from the song from Guitar Hero, stuff like that?
I mean, in the early 2000s, there was a sequence of commercials, Guitar Hero. Pretty much right when I came back to the band, Kansas was enjoying a little bit of celebrity from their past because of the TV, the Guitar Hero. There was an episode of
South Park.
South Park, that's what it was.
Yeah.
There was a couple of commercials. Dust in the Wind and Point of No Return were featured on Toyota commercials, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
And it actually helped. And our audience did become a little younger. And I tell you, man, one of the most rewarding things that can happen to me at a Kansas show is looking down and finding the 14-year-old kid who has never really seen a performing rock group. I mean, I hate to belittle what's going on in rock right now, but
no one
can play. You know, it's all teeny bop singing stuff, and there's really no musicians in the band. There are no guitar solos anymore and stuff like that. And you find the little 14-year-old kid, you can tell he's never really seen a band play before. And just watching his face as stuff is happening, it's very rewarding to see that. That is so much fun.
So I guess we've got a wonderful range of folks in their 60s to folks in their teens and even tweens coming to Kansas shows nowadays.
Oh, yeah, man, it's a wide audience. It really is. And it's fun because you have parents and grandparents who brought their kids up listening to, you know.
Right.
And it's really a testimony to the material that was written by all those bands at that time. That period in the 70s was incredibly prolific and incredibly inspiring. There were a bunch of guys writing really, really timeless music.
You brought up something that really reminded me. Kansas was also at the era when we started going from clubs to arenas. I mean, you know, baseball.
That's true.
So you as a performer, what is your preference? I mean, seeing that wave of you can't even count the number of people or being in a club where you can see the sweat on a person's glass.
The small theater is my favorite venue.
Yeah.
The 2,500 seat theater, because those theaters sound so good. The stages are wood. Everything in the room is wood, or it was crafted for a symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
So the acoustics are remarkable. And it holds enough people to get your adrenaline going. But honestly, once it exceeds 20,000, it just completely loses its meaning. You have to be able to pick out individuals in the audience to play to. That's the fun part. You find the people who are interested, and you play to them. And there's a little interaction that goes on. And it turns into almost an energy-feeding frenzy. They're excited, which excites you, so you work a little harder, which excites them more, which excites you more, and you work a little harder, which excites them and excites you. You know, and it really, by the end of the show, there is an energy feeding frenzy that is incredibly intense. It's so much fun when you get into that kind of show. And happily, Kansas is able to pull that off frequently. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and it builds and builds and builds, and by the end of it, I don't want to use the word orgasmic, but I can't come up with anything better than that. It's not orgasmic, but it's close.
I've been speaking with David Ragsdale, and that last bit of music from his solo release, David and Goliath, well worth checking out. David Ragsdale, along with Kansas, will be at Morongo Casino and Resort Friday, June 1st. More information at MorongoCasinoResort.com.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. Just ahead, we have Sahar Khajnouri with music and conversation with singer-songwriter Pete Sands of Black Kiss.
Day in four.
Day four, Rose Ducky.
Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm Sahar Khajnouri. Tonight is music and conversation with dark country musician and filmmaker Pete Sands of Black Kiss. And you can find his and other artist music videos on the Aboriginal Unity Experience, the Indigenous music video series from FNX, fnx.org/theox.
Nobody heard another suicide, that's the worst.
Hail from Hail Mary, follow these demons to save your soul.
Save Your Soul. We'll be talking about that video and more. But first, we're going to start with introducing our guest, Mr. Pete Sands.
Yate, Shea Pete Sands with you. Shea Montezuma Creek, Utah, did not show. My name is Pete Sands, and I'm from Montezuma Creek, Utah. Good to be here.
And we're really excited to have you here. So can you tell us what language you just introduced yourself in?
I just spoke in my native tongue, the Navajo Indian language, which where I come from the Navajo Nation, Utah portion of the Navajo Nation.
A cool little tidbit that I don't think many of our listeners might know is that you and I went to the same high school together. We were the White Horse
High School Raiders.
Woohoo!
Yes, shout out to White Horse High School. Hosts the Blackest Show every once a year. Annual Blackest Show, Montezuma Creek, Utah.
Pete, our community is so proud of you, and you have so much love and so much support, and you've just developed this amazing fan base, both within our community and even into a broader Native community and even non-Native. So I'm really excited that you're on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your double role. You are a musician, but you're also a filmmaker. And your first short film project was a music film called Save Me. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes, my good friend Fernando, he's from Seattle. I could have that wrong, but I think he's from Seattle. He reached out to me asking me if I could make a music video, and he couldn't be in the area, so he says, you got to kind of, you know, do what you do with it. And so I listened to the song, and the song spoke to me in a certain way. It just spoke to me in the way that a way I made it, I guess. And it's a short film about angels and demons and a demon hunting an angel for a debt that she owed him. And it was something that was I did on the fly. I like the fact, you know, guerrilla filmmaking, which is like you just go with what your gut instinct is, and the whole handheld feel about it is what I really like about it. And I really loved the way it came out, especially the film version of it, which is has the intro, which I introduced the film and the character, and you were on it too, Sahar. You're in it. I got you in it. Filmed it outside of Salt Lake City, Utah, in the desert, and it came out really great. It's where I learned all about editing and color correction, which is very important to any film, is color correction.
There's an ancient story of an angel who fell in love with a human. But the heavens forbid such things, so she sought out the help of a demon, and he granted her her wish. But the demon warned her, one of these days, I'll come calling, you better answer. That's the deal. So she loved. She got to love. But life as we know it is unpredictable, and one day, the love of her life passed on. And this death drove her mad. So when the demon came calling, she ran. Ran as far as she could. And the demon chases. Word is that the demon caught up with her somewhere in New Mexico. Cornered her. Some ancient hollow grounds. Don't really know what happened.
Speaking of angels, I notice a trend or a reoccurring theme in a lot of your projects. How do angels come into play in your life?
That's something I ask myself all the time. What's this obsession with angels, which is, you know, I think it's connected to my whole thing with crows and ravens. As a kid growing up in a reservation, you would go to vacation Bible school, mainly just so you can have your free punch and cookies. But you go there and they teach you this whole new concept of what God and being is, partly separate from your own culture, indigenous cultures, and Navajo culture. But as I grew older and I had people from both sides, from the Christian side, the Catholic side, and my own Navajo side, which had shamans and medicine men and medicine women, they would tell me that all religions are the same in a certain way. We're all connected in some way. So as I became more creatively intuitive, I just started making these connections. It just seemed to fit so well together. And the idea of indigenous angels, it just seemed so out there that my first short story I wrote about angels back in college, my professor is like, where did you come up with this? And it didn't seem that radical to think Native Americans can be angels. And that kind of made me think, like, what's indigenous people categorized as is just who people see on TV. And sometimes Native Americans, we do it to ourselves. We keep ourselves in a box. But we have to branch out of there. And it's not like I wasn't trying to be different. It just came out that way.
So the videos that we've broadcasted here on the Ox on FNX, In the Dark, Hell Dorado, Indian Girl, and something that we shot here was I'm on Fire.
Yeah.
How did you gravitate toward that song? Because you do it well.
Well, I always tell the story because people always, last time I was in Flagstaff, Arizona, 2 months ago, I had a show out there. I stopped at the Maverick out there in Flagstaff, putting on some gas, and some lady's like, hey, aren't you the I'm on Fire guy? So it was, you know, I've been linked to that song now, but I actually learned it from my good friend Whitey Morgan. After a show we had together, he told me, you know, you need some Bruce Springsteen in your life. And so he taught me how to play that song. You have to cover songs you can relate to. You can't just cover something just because it's popular, because you will be linked to that song, and you have to be able to understand and explain why you chose that song and why it means something, because that song does mean something to the fans out there of that person who wrote it.
I'm on fire.
And when I sang it, it just opened up something in me. It's just like, you know, it's hard to describe. It's like you finally find someone, a song someone else wrote that you could have wrote yourself. That's the best explanation I can give for that.
Daddy home, let it go away, leave you all alone, uh-huh. Got a bad desire. Oh, 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 I'm on fire. Tell me now, baby, is it good to you? Does it do to you do things that I do? Oh, no, I can take you higher. Sometimes it's like someone took a knife, baby, a gin don't cut a six-inch fatty through the middle of my skull. Now you wake up when the sheet's soaking wet and the freight train running through the middle of my head, and you can cool my desire. Oh, 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 I'm on fire.
That dedication to the lyrics and your delivery, I think that's what really makes you stand out.
That's Sahar Khajnouri and music in conversation with singer-songwriter and filmmaker Pete Sands of Blackus. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
Indian Girl is a new video that and a new song that you've released since your first interview on KVC Arts. Indian Girl, really, it's really almost haunting. How did you, where were you? Where was your mindset at when you were writing these lyrics?
I think when I wrote Indian Girl, I was in the beginning of kind of like finding your way into another relationship after being out of one for so many years. And you just, when people ask you, what are you looking for in another person? If which everybody was always asked that question. And I never had an answer for it. So one day when I was at my house and I was reading this thing on the album covers of a Waylon Jennings album, it's called Belle of the Ball. And if you ever heard of Waylon Jennings' song, Belle of the Ball, he talks about, it's not about a woman. He's singing about industry. But to me, I was thinking, what if he was writing this about a woman? This is like a really romantic song for Waylon Jennings, kind of like Waltz Me to Heaven. And so I went downstairs, and people always ask my Indian Girl and how I wrote it. I wrote that whole song at that moment, right there. I was just playing along the chords, and I felt the rhythm, like I knew it was already there. This was the rhythm I knew for some reason. And then the words just came out. So within a span of having that mere thought, the thought of writing a song, which took about 5 minutes, walked downstairs, sat in my garage for another 5 minutes. Within that time span, I wrote that whole song. This one's called Indian Girl. I'm sitting all alone, taking care of the fire. I see you over there dancing with the elders, moving your feet in your old moccasins, looking so pretty in the dress your mama made. They tell me I'm lucky to have a woman like you, but I've always known that since I first seen you, with your big brown eyes and your long dark hair. You take everything and make it much better. I can't lie to you, it's simply the truth. My beautifully strong driving all alone through the desert country. You fix your hair without a strand out of place. You pull me out to dance at the old ceremonies. Tell me I'm lucky to have a woman like you. But I've always known that since I first seen you, with your big brown eyes and your long dark hair. You take everything and make it much better. I can't lie to you, it's simply the truth. My beautifully strong Indian girl. With your big brown eyes and your long dark
lie to you. It's simply the truth. My beautifully strong ending girl.
So it's just one of those songs that just comes out of you. You know, it's a song about truly appreciating the person you're with and what they bring to the table, and that's something I would never have written 5 years ago. But I think age catches up with everybody and gives you a different perspective of life, and it's, I remember hearing Chris Cornell when they asked him when he wrote the Audioslave song Be Yourself, he explained it kind of like that. He says 10 years ago I would never wrote a song like this, but I'm comfortable in my own skin now to be able to really express the different parts of me that no one's ever really seen. And it's very vulnerable to put yourself out there like that, but Indian Girl has such a positive response from people, and especially in the indigenous community, they really like it. And even at Slum Fest in Nashville, man, people love that song. So there's something to it. I just don't know what it is, but I keep playing it.
So many of us relate to it, I think. Or maybe we want to be that Indian girl that you're singing about.
Maybe. I don't know. You know, it is one of those songs where it was one of my easiest ones to write, but it wasn't easy to play in front of other people, if that makes sense. Yeah.
I could see that. You know, you're vulnerable at that moment.
Yes.
Right?
Mm.
Mm. Speaking of vulnerability, I know that when you're producing, whether it's music videos or films or music, you're really putting yourself out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your most recent project, putting yourself out there, was another video, another short film about angels.
Yeah.
Do you care to elaborate? And what is the title of your most recent piece, and where did you submit it to?
I had a friend of mine in Vegas, his name is Alex, he used to manage a cigar lounge out there, and he found me on Instagram, and he's like, Pete, man, I'm so enamored by your Instagram layout, your pictures and everything, the way you see the world, you can bring other people into your world just by a picture. And said, okay, so he says, let's do something together. So a couple months later, I came back through Vegas, and I had my camera, and he asked, let's go do something. I said, all right, go buy yourself some clothes that you would like to see yourself in. And he comes back wearing a Western shirt that I wear.
Yes, I saw
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I was like, okay. And we went out to a Red Rock Canyon, and we went out there and we shot, which is a beautiful place. And I didn't have a plan at the moment. He just wanted some footage of him that was shot by me. So I think instinctively or just subconsciously, I was thinking about something already, and I did these shots of him walking and smoking a cigar, and I just kept it at that, and he thanked me for bringing him into this world. This guy has thousands of followers, but he chose to come into my world. So if you look into his pictures at his layout, his name is Alex Cigar Dandy is his Instagram name, but he has beautiful pictures like of him from other photographers, then you see the one that we took of him, and it looks nothing like he's ever done. And it's a huge compliment to me when people ask me to bring them into my world, because I don't think my world's that exciting or anything, but it's about freedom and creativity, to be somebody you wanted to be. So when I took the footage back, and the LA Skins Fest here in Los Angeles, they asked me to submit something to them. I told them, I don't have anything. So they're like, you got a week and a half. Can you shoot something in a week and a half? So I said, I got some footage of a buddy of mine in LA, and I'm in Vegas, but he's just smoking a cigar, so that's not really anything. So I put together this script real quick, and I asked a friend of mine, Cassandra Legay, to be in it. And Alex, I told Alex, yeah, I'm going to get these good actors to be in it. He says, no, I want you in it. And I said, why? I don't want... He says, I came into your world, and it won't be fair if you're not in it. So you have to be in your own world. So I put it together, and I put myself in it, and took a week to shoot it, and had you voice over as well, Sahar Kajanor, voice over artist.
It was supposed to be anonymous.
And it came together really well, because when I showed it to the people who I was supposed to show it to, they're like, dude, this is like a comic book. Like, you brought a comic book to life. And somehow the Sundance Film Festival people got a hold of it. I don't know who sent it to them. I didn't send it to them. But they wrote me back saying, you got to make a feature-length film with this. You got to. Because we need different filmmakers. And this story you have here, there's something here. And they, you know, Native Americans and angels. There's something there, man. You got to make something. So the short film I made with Alex, Cassandra, Sahar, and I is called Dirty Wings. It's about angels who are half-breed, half-human, half-angels, and debts that need to be collected. And yeah, it turned out really good. I mean, I made myself look good, which is good.
If you're reading this, then it was meant for you to read. Let me start with this. Angels are real, no matter what you believe. I know. I fell in love with one.
I love working with other people, especially people who come from different cultures, because Alex is Serbian. 6'7" Serbian guy. And he wanted to be a cowboy his whole life. And he got the chance to be a cowboy. He was so happy and honored that I let him wear my hat in the video. He was like, he was shaking when I gave him my hat. I was like, dude, it's just a hat, dude. Just wear it. He says, no, this is you. This hat is you and your power. You don't understand. I said, I think I'm starting to. But he was really good to work with, you know. It's always fun to try something new and challenge yourself. You don't have to have the best equipment. You don't have to have the $1,000 cameras. You know, it's limitations that unlock your creativity, and that's what I like about it.
You mix it up.
Yeah. It's important to keep an open mind.
That open mind most recently can be seen, reflected in your music video. You did a collaboration with Joey Styles.
Yes.
Save Your Soul. Hello, wow, country music meets hip-hop meets visual artistry. Wow, how did this come about, and what was that process like?
Joey hit me up last year. Like, he found me on Instagram like everybody else does, and he shot me a message asking, he said he was a fan of mine, and I was a fan of Joey's for years before that, and, I was, at the time, I wasn't really looking forward to branch out from the country Americana scene I was a part of. But Joey Styles, he's one of the most prolific rappers in Canada. He's an indigenous rapper, but he's more than that. He's beyond the label of just being just an indigenous rapper. He's a good rapper. He's a great hip-hop artist. And there's many of them like that. Many indigenous artists who are undiscovered, or people haven't heard of them yet, and I was just very thankful that he chose to reach out to me. And he reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to write a song together, and I said, yeah, we'll try something together. And so I had a hook that I had a song I had written, and he asked me to write a hook and just send him some ideas. So I sent him some guitar chords and a song with a chorus that I wrote, and I sent it to him, and him and his producer, you know, they made a beat to it, and they sent me just a rough cut in it. I was like, all right, this sounds pretty good. And just like any person who's ever done something for the first time that's completely out of the norm, I was a little nervous because I didn't know how it was going to come out. And so it took about 6 months to do, 6 months to finish the song because we're both so busy. But like a month before it was released, he sent me the final version. I was blown away. I was like, this is candy. This is a gem. And I was very excited to see how people would react to it, especially because Joey, he's worked with many different artists, and I've never really worked with many others. And so I was very curious to how people would react to it, and the response to me has been tremendously positive. And we are on the Indigenous Music Countdown in Canada, and last I checked, we are number 11, so... getting up there, Sirius Radio, Satellite Radio, Countdown.
Bravo, bravo.
Started from 40, now we're 11, so.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How many other words it take to get me? When I'm gone, will my post represent? I don't know, at least not for sure. Nail on the coffin, this life's a blur. So I proceed with a pocket full of trees. My medicine bag and spirit of a G.
Can't talk about it just yet, but there's another hip-hop song that I'm working on with Joey and some guys. I can't even talk about anybody, so I can't mention any names. Like, I wish I could say who, but it's the part of the business you can't tell until they say it's okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking this would be a KBC Arts, FNX, all exclusive. But I guess we'll have to wait for that.
I'll call in and tell it.
That's Sahar Kajanori in Music and Conversation with singer-songwriter and filmmaker Pete Sands of Blackkiss. More at blackkissdrifters.com. You can also find Pete all over YouTube and on the AUX, the music video service of FNX, First Nations Experience. Go to fnx.org/theAUX. That's AUX. That's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to David Ragsdale, Pete Sands, and to Sahar Kajanori. Sorely missed here. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Isel Quapio, Jessica Greenwell, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR, it's composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support of public radio, which you can do at kvcrnews.org any time of the year. And thanks again.